The gay rights movement has its landmarks. In New York, the Stonewall Inn and Christopher Street. San Francisco has the Castro and Market districts. But what of Detroit? LGBT historian Tim Retzloff realized there was a rich history in Detroit's gay community that hadn't been properly told. That omission has now been corrected with the dissertation that earned Tim Retzloff his PhD from Yale. Two volumes, 680 pages, taking an exhaustive look at gay life and history in the city and its suburbs from 1945 to 1985. Tim, you're from Flint and you now live and teach in East Lansing. Why did you want to take this detailed look at Detroit?
I grew up in Flint, which is not the most gay-friendly town in the 1980s, which is when I would have been coming out. Mm-hmm. The primary outlets were bars. Michigan, you know, you had to be 21 to drink. So my first time in a gay bar in Flint, I was kicked out. Mm-hmm. So I eventually found an organization called Dignity Flint, which was nominally Catholic, but basically functioned as kind of a gay men's group in the city for its long history. And that kind of helped me kind of bridge that gap. But certainly in high school, when I was first realizing, you know, who I was, it was a very difficult time.
So this dissertation drove you back to college and kind of put you, it pulled you right through to the point where you're sitting here today with this history that you've done. Did you have some hypothesis or mission statement that you were writing to, or did you just dig and report what you found?
Once I realized I wanted to, you know, write the dissertation, I went back to school. And I was working full-time here at the University of Michigan and started taking classes part-time. And one of the first classes I took was A History of American Suburbia with Matthew Laster. And it was in the midst of that class that things suddenly clicked, because all this material I'd found on Detroit suddenly started making sense. Detroit had a different story than what you were finding in New York and San Francisco or even the other cities that had been done. So with Detroit, it's really Metro Detroit, and it's very much a picture of looking at both the suburbs and the cities. And right now, if you look at LGBT activism in Detroit, you know, the Affirmations Community Center is in Ferndale, mm-hmm. kind of the centers of gay nightlife, and organizations are Royal Oak and Ferndale.
They moved just ever so slightly north of Palmer Woods.
But they're there, yeah. They're in residentially, mm-hmm. certainly. Mm-hmm. There's the inner ring suburbs. So that's a different, but then at the same time, you've got kind of this rich African-American gay life that's still going on in the city. And up until really the 1990s, bar life was in the city. So you've got, you know, at its peak in the mid-80s, you've got like 50 gay bars. All but two or three of them are in Detroit. They have a largely white clientele.
Coming from the burbs.
Coming from the burbs. So you've got kind of that relationship going on.
That you don't exactly. see as much in New York or in Chicago or San Francisco.
Right. And so the geography is different.
The geography is, but the result is?
The result is, I think, a different kind of gay politics in some respects.
How so?
Well, I think the kind of transition from gay liberation into what happened in Detroit, the first organization after gay liberation was founded in 1975, called the Association of Suburban People.
When would you give us a sense of the time frame for the gay lib movement?
Sure. The first organization in Detroit was a very short-lived chapter of the Mattachine Society, which lasted 17 months from 58 to 60. And it was a group that was very, very fearful of being exposed. So people were afraid to even use their names. They were afraid to have public meeting spaces. But they had a couple of achievements, one of which was they produced a newsletter. So it's kind of the first kind of gay-generated organ of disseminating information. Once that folded, the next organization that started in Detroit actually started in Grosse Pointe. It was a group called One in Detroit. It was founded by a Grosse Pointe travel agent and former school teacher named Chet Sampson, who had moved to Los Angeles and felt a little more open to come out, but he still had ties to Detroit, and he started this organization.
Okay.
And now we use the word closeted. For this time period, it might be more accurate to say they were more masks, because the sense of the closet wasn't what it was until later.
And keeping in mind, at this time, homosexuality was still considered a mental illness.
It was considered,
right?
A mental illness. Yeah. It was certainly criminal at the time and highly stigmatized. Mm-hmm. And yet you had people who were gay, of course, and people who were gay in the cities and in the suburbs that were invested in keeping their secret because of their job, because of their family, because of their home. So One in Detroit was kind of this organization that actually bridged Stonewall and gay liberation, and it was still going out, and they were the old fogies in the early 70s. So 1970 was when the gay liberation movement started in Detroit, soon became the Gay Liberation Front, in part from the spark of Stonewall and that wave across the country, but also, much like other gay liberation, built on the counterculture movement, the anti-war movement, the Black Power movement,
everything,
feminism,
that was going on.
It's all exactly.
When I think about all of that, and so much of the time frame of your dissertation is long before that. You're looking at 1945 to 1985. Why that time span?
So 1945, so World War II is seen as kind of a major turning point for kind of the emerging gay subculture nationally, in part because of the conditions of the war and how it brought people together in certain cities like never before. So someone who might have, you know, had crushes down on the farm.
In Kansas. Yes.
Or Northern Oakland County was suddenly in a city, maybe mobilized. So they're suddenly in troops and being deployed and having exposure to a gay world that they might not have known existed. And in Detroit, certainly that was going on because Detroit was the arsenal of democracy.
So many coming to work in the factories.
Right, right.
So it blew the lid off things for a lot of people at a time when it wasn't safe to be out.
Right, right. And so, and simultaneous with this is 1945, you see the beginning of the post-war suburbs. So I was kind of telling both of these stories simultaneously. So that's why the beginning point is. The end point at 1985 is for a couple reasons, one of which is I attended my first Pride March in 1986. And as a historian, I believe I shouldn't be part of my history that I'm writing.
So it's a good place to cut it off, yeah.
But also for Detroit, by the mid-80s, you see kind of the end result of this trend toward the suburbs, and you see the early impact of AIDS, which was delayed from other cities or in the country. There was kind of a lag time, but it did hit Detroit as well. So that kind of changes the story too. And so unless I wanted to extend it another 10 years, 1985 seemed like the natural point.
Based on all the research you've done, how would you characterize or describe Metro Detroit's gay community from that time period in that 40 years?
Emerging and growing in very interesting ways. I mean, geographically dispersing from an area where the bars were centered right downtown to over time kind of being spread throughout the city, in part depending on where the expressways were built. Mm-hmm. But then kind of reacting to national trends and events politically in its own unique way. So the Anita Bryant campaign in 1977, where she had the Save Our Children campaign and successfully pushed for the repeal of a human rights ordinance in Miami-Dade County, Florida. The response in Detroit was to mobilize. And Detroit had already, had at least established enough of an infrastructure where they brought in people from various organizations, but also people involved in bar life, in Metropolitan Community Church, which is a primarily gay and lesbian church, to kind of say, we don't want that to happen here, and establish the Michigan Organization for Human Rights, which really is kind of the early manifestation of what became Equality Michigan. So we've kind of got this continuity thread from there to today.
But isn't it interesting, as we sit here in 2014, the Elliott Larson Act still is missing in one rather large clause.
Exactly, and was an early project of the Michigan Organization for Human Rights.
How do you think this process of what you've gone through, all this research and the writing and the thinking and the talking to people, how has that affected or impacted the way you see yourself as a gay man in Michigan in 2014?
I did a fair amount of some of my research at the Library of Michigan in Lansing. And so I've become acquainted with Leroy Barnett, who is the former archivist for the state. And he would, you know, periodically check in with me. And so when I was finally done, I wanted to show him the finished dissertation. And so I loved him. I loved watching him look through that. But he made this point to me. It's like, okay, you need to remember who you were as a kid. And what the story is, what the story is from there to here. So kind of in response to your question, you know, there's kind of this lonely 17-year-old. And, you know, certainly my personal experience has led me to understand I'm not the only one in the world. But now that I know kind of this rich history, not only am I not the only one in the world, but, you know, 40, 50 years ago, people were not the only ones in the world. It was just kind of a different configuration of how society was, and that it was much, much harder to find people. But people were able to find people, and that is kind of the stunning story, that this myth that people were isolated and invisible and perpetually scared is much more complicated than that, and that there was constant rejection. Everybody, you know, this idea that everyone felt they had to move to San Francisco. Well, yes, lots of people moved to San Francisco, but lots of people stayed. And to what extent were their families maybe more welcoming? And maybe how does that complicate our understanding of why marriage is such a big issue right now, and how that happened so quickly? You know, the New York and San Francisco don't explain that. Life in the suburbs does.
Sounds like a new book. Tim Retzloff, who has just completed his dissertation, earned his PhD from Yale on his gay history of Detroit, the gay rights movement, and the history of gay life in Detroit and its suburbs, teaching at Michigan State University. Tim, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much.